potentially, Jim, if they did do a deal, what could it look like?
Well, you know, I think it's also fascinating. You know, there's, you know, maybe a change of rules in 2027 where there's a salary cap. So you see a lot of short-term deals. That's, you know, primarily what the organization has been focusing on is short-term deals. But and they also develop pitching well. So yeah, I think that all has to kind of factor into any type of offer that you make to Freddy Peralta. And you hope that he's willing to take a discount or a little bit of a discount. But you also know he's coming off one where it was a steep discount there in Milwaukee. So I think, you know, where you see like some of the free agents this year, they got 5 years at 30 years old, you know, in terms of a guy like Suarez as an example. I don't see the Mets going to 5 years on anything like that. If he was willing to do 4 years and if it was around 28 to 30 million bucks,
right,
you know, 120 total, that might be in the possibility. And if, you know, he does have an agent that has done deals before. He was David Wright's agent. The Aces have been. They have also other Mets, Cliff Floyd back in the day. I think there's a willingness there. You could even do it into the season like they did with Francisco Lindor.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, February the 1st, 2026, of course. I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. And I'd love for you to join the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Join us for chat, free of charge, premium content over at Extra Innings, updates on the show, interact with me, all types of fun over at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And, of course, I want to thank the folks on the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here on this cold Sunday, Super Bowl week. This is when we start to turn from the hot stove into spring training. We put the hot stove away. We put the transaction log away. I know there's still a ton of free agents out there. Will the Mets get opportunistic? Maybe. But that's not the focus of the show. I think that it's pretty clear that the Mets will always take a look at what players are falling to them. And that might be an interesting theme throughout February. And maybe into March, we'll see. Maybe some players are just going to, especially veterans like a Max Scherzer or Justin Verlander, maybe they'll sit out until there's a need throughout the regular season, stay ready, do to a certain extent what the just-retired David Robertson did last year, spend some time with their family and be mercenary hired guns for teams that are in the postseason World Series hunt. But what I'm going to talk about today, I think I'm going to annoy you a little bit. I'll put that out there up front. Freddy Peralta was introduced to the media. There's talk about an extension. I'm going to tell you why that's probably a bad idea. I think the Mets need to slow the roll on the extension talk. I've been talking for weeks about Justin Willard, the Mets' new pitching coach. Who is this guy? Can we do a profile of him? I've done some research. It's not easy, especially a guy who's never really been never pitched in the big leagues, has spent a good deal of time in the shadows with both Minnesota and Boston. Maybe that's a national profile or from a New York perspective. I'm sure that the fans of the Red Sox knew him very well. But I'll talk a little bit about Justin Willard and what I think he'll bring to the pitching staff and really why I personally feel Jeremy Hefner was fired after what, you know, what we all thought was a successful run, and he was well-respected and highly regarded throughout his tenure. So I think those two things are connected. We'll end the show with a few mailbags, some comments. It was a little bit lighter this week, the mailbag. I think all of us are kind of gearing up, maybe taking a break. It was a wild January, especially mid to late January with the transaction log, the ups and the downs. I even said for a while there I was tired from the shows we were doing day in and day out, but tons of fun. So this is our last show before we take our week off for the Super Bowl and then really gear up pitchers and catchers. We get full spring training mode, and the journey starts. 162 games in 180 days, spring training, and hopefully tons of postseason, and all the different things that we do here at the Talking Mets podcast as we live the journey together, starting with pitchers and catchers, and that's where the Super Bowl is kind of that turning point. It's that demarcation line for us here, at least at this show. So Freddy Peralta is a Met. He got to meet the media, and right away, and you heard it from Jim Duquette, there's talk of an extension, and I've gotten the emails, I've seen the commentary on X. Fans are really up in arms and, you know, concerned about, okay, got to sign Freddy Peralta, got to get him to an extension. I think there's a large percentage, if not all, Mets fans who feel that way, and it's understandable. The Mets just gave up two top prospects, top five prospects in Jet Williams and Brandon Sproat, for a pitcher that they may only have for 30 starts and maybe a little bit more going into the postseason. And that's okay. And that's where I am to tell you that's okay. And this is not going to be an anti-Freddy Peralta show. I already outlined, you could go back and listen to it right after the trade. I like the trade. I think the Mets, and there's been a lot of talk, a lot of great reporting over at The Athletic by Will Salmon, how other executives noticed that the Mets really methodically executed their offseason. And from a prospect perspective, were able to keep those that they didn't want to trade. And they took from some of their, when you're a top five organization in prospects, you have, I shouldn't say expendable inventory, but excessive inventory that you can afford maybe to use that as a chip to improve your big league roster. That's where the Mets have gotten very quickly. Credit to obviously David Stearns and his team, but they were starting to build that up over Billy Epler and Zach Scott. I think Stearns and his team supercharged it over the last two seasons or so. And give credit to the organization for player development, because there are players here that were drafted before Stearns and started to develop under him. So the Mets were able to achieve what historically has been difficult, because they haven't had, especially over the last two decades, or maybe longer, a farm system that had the kind of depth where if you made a big deal, you felt comfortable giving away those prospects and then losing the player and being able to replenish the talent that you gave up. The Mets feel confident on that, and they should. If you just go up and down, and prospects are suspects until they prove themselves, we all know that, but the Mets have a lot of next man up with A.J. Ewing, with Jet Williams. In terms of Sproat, you've got Winiger, you've got Will Watson, you've got Santucci, you've got Christian Scott, who everybody has forgotten about. Jonah Tong, this top pitching prospect that was making big starts down the stretch, right now very likely won't make the rotation out of spring training. So the Mets have right now a position that they haven't had in a long time, and it could go away really quick. These guys can never develop, they could get hurt, we all know that. But the idea that you need to go into this season, rush to sign Freddy Peralta, is the same logic that I pushed back on when they acquired, for actually a lesser cost, there was some proven ceilings with Andrés Giménez and Edmed Rosario for Francisco Lindor. Think about it. The Mets got a Hall of Fame shortstop for a guy, a Rosario, who was a top prospect in baseball, by the way, who now is a utility player. And Giménez, who's a nice component player, he's pretty much what we thought he would be, a component player. I always thought he'd be like an Omar Vizquel type. He's probably got a much better bat than Vizquel, more power, but a nice component player, gold glove. You're a very useful player, a player that if he was available and you had a need up the middle, you'd probably be all in on, but nobody that's going to give you significant pain. And I think that's, you know, when Lindor came over, we'll go back to that, I was always like, hey, before you commit, and that was more about committing dollars to a franchise player that was going to be here a decade. And I know that the game has changed where they're not looking to do 10, 12-year deals. It's more about short-term deals, higher AAV. And we don't know what the CBA is going to look at like in a year or two. And that's also part of this. But you know me, I was against giving Lindor the contract going into the season. Let him prove that he likes New York. Let him prove that he's into this whole thing. And the Mets didn't do that. They wanted to solidify a foundational player, and they were right about it. I was wrong, but it took some time. 2021 was a roller coaster ride, and then it wasn't until the following year, 2022, when he started to show the kind of player that he's been. And ever since then, he's been, from an offensive standpoint, even with Soto, he's pretty much been the heart and soul of that offense, getting all the big hits. The Mets don't make it to the NLCS without him. As a matter of fact, the Mets don't make the playoffs without Lindor, the one season that they did make the playoffs while he was here, since he's been here. So I was wrong about that, but I think the same thought process has to apply here. I think back then, because of the lack of spending by the Wilpons, because Cohen had just taken over, the fans were obviously frustrated and had a lot of PTSD from all the disappointments during the Wilpon years and losing Jose Reyes. And look, Mets fans over their history, and I think it goes all the way back to the Tom Seaver trade, they really have this fear of losing players and them going on to great things. Maybe it's the Nolan Ryan trade. Maybe it's the fact that they saw Strawberry walk and Reyes walk. And if you go, you know, through and through their history, you know, Hampton leaving after the World Series, recently Diaz and Pete moving on. I mean, Mets fans get attached to their players, rightfully so. That's part of it. And they don't want to see them leave. But when you really think about it, very few players that the Mets have traded outside of what I said, Orion or something. I mean, think about the Jared Kelnick trade that now you don't even think about Kelnick. You're worried about Diaz. Nobody wanted just 7 years ago. Have gone back to burn them. And I think that that's a part of the repertoire that I think Mets fans have to start to feel comfortable with. And I'll tell you why. Before I get to that, why don't I want to extend Freddy Peralta? Well, I think we need to see if Freddy Peralta not only is emerging after a really good 2025 into the top of the rotation ace that I think a lot of people think he could be. Because like I said, he's good, but he's in the same category as, hey, Joe Ryan, George Kirby, emerging very good arms. He's not Skubal. He's not Skeens. He's not Zach Wheeler before he got hurt. He's not even Christopher Sanchez over in Philadelphia, who's a top pitcher. He's a very good pitcher who is starting to inch his way to the top of the rotation status, and he did that last year in Milwaukee, but he didn't have a great postseason. He had a better postseason than maybe he's had in the past, and I think that's part of the puzzle here, and I think that will potentially be part of the puzzle here in New York that he has to prove. And he doesn't go very deep into the games. Maybe they could get another inning or so. You start to become an ace, you want to be able to get into the seventh inning, not get out in the sixth. I'm not asking for complete games. I'm not asking for him to go 130 pitches every time out, but maybe get us into the seventh inning when he pitches so that there doesn't have to be more than 6 to 8 outs instead of 9 to 12 outs during his starts. And let's let him prove that. And right now, after he signed a undervalued deal, Stearns, credit to him and the Brewers, 7-year deal, made about $30 million. I mean, last year alone, he was worth $29 million, according to Fangraph's WAR converted to dollars. So he already earned his keep at what the Brewers paid him over 7 years in one season. The Brewers got tremendous value out of that contract. So the odds that Peralta wants to sign another generational, like, okay, let me get this money that's generational money for me and my family, but undervalued in terms of baseball. The odds that he wants to do something like that again at the age of 29 going into 30 are very slim. And if you're his agent, why would you advise him otherwise? You advise them to get money to become comfortable. And look, I know I'm talking to people in the audience, $30 million over 7 years. It's crazy money for you, for me, for most everybody. It's enough money where we don't have to worry about a lot the rest of our lives. But when you have a rare talent like Freddy Peralta, you don't want to go out there and just sell low. I mean, that's an obligation you have to yourself as an athlete, as someone who is trying to earn a living. So, you know, you hear Jim Duquette, you hear some of the things that were said in that opening on the Baseball Night in New York, guys. 4 years, $120 million. And personally, I think that that's really where he falls into. I think he's very similar to Ranger Suarez, who signed in Boston with that 5-year deal. Maybe 5 years, $150 million. I really think that's going to be ultimately what Freddy Peralta's value is. Now, he goes out there, wins 20 games, wins a Cy Young, pitches big in the postseason. I'm not saying the Mets have to win a championship. He does all these things. Then all of a sudden, the market changes. Now, going into the volatility of the CBA, maybe that will play into it. But outside of the Peralta and his agent coming to the Mets and say, look, we want to be here. And it didn't sound like that when he was on his call with reporters. It sounded like, hey, I just got here. I want to learn what this is all about. He's got to make a commitment, too. He's got to feel comfortable being in this organization, too. Not just about knowing Stearns. Other than that kind of scenario where the agent comes and says, here, we're ready to sign. And to a certain degree, I think that's what Lindor wanted. I think Lindor wanted the big contract. I think Lindor wanted the bird in hand. I don't think he wanted to go out into the market and get into a bidding war. And actually, it hurt the Mets, Lindor, because he didn't have a great 21. I wonder if that would have changed the course of Mets history. If they had waited, maybe they would have thought about maybe even got a better contract, better, you know, less years. Maybe they would have thought about whether the union made sense. It could have gone both ways. So my point is this, is that to jump and to sign Peralta, I just think is unnecessary. I think with Cohen's largesse, with the Mets' ability to navigate a market, with the number of young arms coming up in the system, I think that you can play this thing out similar to how you played out Mike Hampton. And back then, it was much different, where you were not a team that typically could compete with top free agents. If a top free agent wanted the Yankees, they were going to the Yankees. If a top free agent wanted to go to the Red Sox, they were going to the Red Sox. The Mets were a destination, but they weren't, I think, now where they could really go in and muscle and be part of any conversation. And the Yankees were always that team that you felt like, hey, if I got an ace like Hampton, the next guy out, which was Mike Mussina, if you remember, there's no guarantee I could get him, because first I got to make sure he doesn't want to go to the Yankees. If he wants to go to the Yankees, I'm screwed. And I think that to a certain degree, that's what's playing in Mets' minds, but with the Dodgers now, maybe Mets fans, and you really can't think like that. And I'm not so sure Freddie Peralta is that guy. Freddie Peralta, in a lot of ways, is very similar to Mike Hampton. A very good pitcher that's coming off a very good year in a small market, that may be emerging as the top of the rotation ace, but more than likely is very good. If you really look at Mike Hampton's career and you take a real honest look, he probably was a bit overrated as a top of the rotation starter when the Mets acquired him. Now, he had a great year in 2000. He had an excellent postseason. Without him, they don't get to the World Series. He forever is part of a team that will has left footprints on the fan base and the team history. And ultimately, that's what you hope that Freddie Peralta will do. Now, I know they didn't win a championship, but teams that win pennants, teams that have those kind of runs, that's the kind of teams that leave footprints in our minds and forever will remember those type of players. Now, I know that part of the uncomfortability of not signing Peralta, or maybe the desire to push for signing Peralta, maybe not at all costs, but at a lot of cost, is the fact that they gave up two top five prospects. And I think that as we go forward, as the Mets continue to try to build a functional top-tier organization, part of that is a pipeline. Something that you want to call Tampa not a top-tier organization because they haven't won, but something that Tampa does pretty consistently, something that the Dodgers have done consistently, at times the Yankees have done, although they've kind of taken a step back over the last, I would say, 10 years, maybe a little bit less than that, maybe 7 or 8 years. Part of that is being comfortable parting with talent, being able to use some of those prospects as capital to win now, to have your window. Prospects are somewhat of a ongoing churn and burn. Windows to win come and go. The Dodgers are very clear. They understand right now this is a special window they have. That's why they're doubling down. They're using money to double down and triple down and quadruple down on everything. It took them a long time to get here. Throughout the process, they had many top prospects. And you could go to MLB.com, look at the top prospects for the Dodgers in 16, 17, 18, 19. And, you know, some of them turned out really well. Cody Bellinger, somebody that we've talked about. But there's been a lot of guys that have fallen by the wayside and have not been very productive in their big league careers. Now, think about, let's just use the Dodgers as an example, because there's always that East Coast Dodgers conversation that Cohen basically started when he took over the team. They rented you. Now, I know these are rentals. They were not off-season trades. So it's even more fitting, this conversation, because all the Dodgers got with the examples I'm giving you is half a season. That's it. And maybe 10 starts and obviously postseason run. So back in 2017, they acquire Yu Darvish. One of their headliners was a guy by the name of Willie Calhoun, one of their top prospects. Willie Calhoun is a fringe MLB player. He had one really okay year in Texas. He's bounced around since with Texas. Nobody else in that deal went anywhere. Willie Calhoun, in a lot of ways, could have been their version of Jet Williams, okay? And they got to the World Series. No, they didn't win, but Darvish helped get them there. And that was what the point was in 2017. They wanted to get to the World Series. And they had not gotten there yet at that point. So 2017 was that first foray into that. Yes, I know they lost the Astros and all the sign stealing and all that stuff, whatever. Now in 2018, Manny Machado, you guys know him. He was available. He was going to be a free agent. Baltimore was going nowhere. They rented him. Yusniel Diaz was the headliner. He was their top prospect. Yusnail Diaz has gotten like one at bat in the big leagues. I think he's an indie ball now. Their best return was a league average starter, the Orioles, Dean Kramer, on that deal. And there was a number of other players in the deal. Actually, I think Zach Pop, who made a cameo, a cup of coffee with the Syracuse shuttle. That's going to be a new thing, by the way. The Syracuse shuttle last year was in that deal. And you're not convinced enough yet? Max Scherzer, just a couple of years ago. And I understand Trey Turner was in that deal, and they got a year and a half out of Trey Turner. So it was a little bit more two players, an elite positional player and a towards the end of his career, Cy Young Award winner. Max Scherzer, Trey Turner. Dodgers traded their number one and number two prospects. They tried to get Scherzer. I know the Mets stole him. They probably would have resigned if the Mets hadn't jumped in and beat them. But they gave up Kiber Ruiz, a catcher, premium position, that has been a starting catcher in Washington. He's okay. Josiah Gray, who's been hurt, has been up and down, has had shown some good stuff, but hasn't really put it together. Maybe that's also part of why the Nats have turned over their front office. They haven't really been able to develop anybody. But nobody in those deals, those are three, four, if you put Turner in there, elite players that the Dodgers used to try to win a pennant, to try to win a World Series, and gave up 5 to 6 off the bat, off the top of my head. I'm just doing off the top of my head. I haven't done a deep dive research. 5 to 6 top prospects, all were probably in the top 100 without me even looking, to win now. And they're still churning, and they're still burning, and they still have prospects. And I think that's what the Mets are trying to do. And ultimately, the Dodgers, these were passer-throughs. Darvish, Machado, Scherzer, they were passer-throughs of the organization. To a certain extent, so was Trey Turner. They didn't go and match him. Their own homegrown player, Corey Seager, they let walk. That's why this whole Pete Alonso conversation that continues to have, you got to get over it. And I think that's the part I'm trying to say, and it connects to why. Take a step back, measure twice, cut once, see who Peralta is, see if he's comfortable here. First of all, before we even get into the environment in New York and handling New York in the postseason and things that are going to be the real demarcation line, let's assume the Peralta that we saw in Milwaukee last year is the breakout version. He's the guy that the Mets are getting. That's baseline. Now, does he like New York? Can he handle New York? How is he in the postseason? What is his health projection over the next 5 years? Because you're going to get, you know, it's a 5-year contract. Who knows? He has a big season. You don't know. There could be a team like a Toronto Blue Jays that goes out and pays similar to what they did with Dylan Cease, a 7-year, $200 million deal. Then you got to get out of that. Now, I know what you're saying. Well, that's why you sign him now. But if I'm Peralta and I'm confident in myself and I've already made some money, not by baseball standards, not a lot, but I've made some money. I'm not going to go broke if he's been smart with his salary. Play this thing out. See what's out there. Maybe you get the Dylan Cease contract. You could be leaving $100 million on the table if you sign early. Now, if the Mets want to go bananas, this is our guy. We love him. We're convinced. I doubt that. You want to go give him a big contract, blow him away so he doesn't even think about free agency? You could do that. But why would you? Knowing that Scooble's available, knowing that you have this pipeline of pitchers that very well might be cost-effective and actually might be as good as Peralta. Now, Peralta's established. Even McClain, as good as he was for, 10 starts down the stretch, not established. Christian Scott, small sample size, not established. Tong, we don't know who he is. Winiger, we don't know who he is. Watson is in Double-A last year. Santucci, we don't know who he is. These are all like a lot of Double-A guys. So all this talent, you know, we got like this whole back of our head burnt by Generation K. Yeah, but somebody will develop. Even if you develop 2 to 3 of them, which will be a home run, that's still going to be 2 extra pitchers that you have, cost-controlled, that maybe you want to do a Freddy Peralta-type deal with on the, you know, young side. Why lock up capital now just because you're afraid of losing the guy? And I know that we go back to Lindor. Position players are different. I think the time in Mets history is different. And personally, I think if they acquire Lindor today in a similar circumstance, I'm not so sure they lock him up long-term before the season. I'm not so sure. And there's a lot behind the scenes we don't know, what Lindor had said, what Lindor wanted, and what have you. I think the Mets have to be comfortable with, and I think Scooble would have been different. Because if I was having a conversation about Scooble, I would say if you gave up 5 big-time prospects and ripped apart your farm system for Skubal, that's silly for 30 starts. That's why the Mets never got serious on Skubal, because that's pretty much what Detroit wants. Detroit wants someone to clean out their pipeline. And when I say that, it's not just farm talent. It would have been big league roster, Beatty-type talent that, at that point, you cannot do that. It's a big difference giving up a couple of prospects. There's a big difference between what I talked to about with what the Mets did with Peralta, Darvish, Machado, Scherzer. I mean, maybe Machado at that time was more, but that was a quantity deal at the deadline with one headliner. Skubal's not going to be a quantity deal with a headliner. Maybe at the deadline. And look, if Detroit is out of this thing or not playing well, what the Dodgers did with a Darvish or Machado or a Scherzer Turner, maybe that's a conversation we're having in July. Don't discount it. And the Mets, why would you, because you're going to potentially want to lock up Skubal after the season, why would you want to commit capital now when there's so much uncertainty with all the things in play? Not just with Peralta, with the CBA, with the availability of big pitchers. We haven't even gotten to Skeens, who eventually, and I think the Pirates are actually going to be pretty good this year, so I'd be curious to see how that plays out. It would be a good coup for baseball that the best pitcher in the sport, or 1A, 1B, whatever, if you want to compare him with Skubal, I think he's better than Skubal, signs with a small market team, a team that's had a rich history, rich baseball history, but for the last 35 years has fallen on hard times because of the economics of the sport. So that could be something that's, you know, you don't know what's going to happen, but you want to keep your options open. You're going to be able to sign a Freddy Peralta if you want to. By the way, they were if you really want to be honest, to a certain degree, Framber Valdez is Freddy Peralta. Ranger Suarez is Freddy Peralta to a certain degree. Now, I think that there is more upside with Peralta, and I think that's where the exciting part of all this plays versus a Valdez or a Suarez who are who they are. There could be the next gear with Peralta, but if it's going to happen, it's going to happen now. It's not going to happen 3 years from now when he's 32, 31. It's going to happen now. The fact that he had the season that he had last year shows that maybe he's pushing in that direction. So this is the brave new world of being a Mets fan. You have to be comfortable being uncomfortable. It's more about the laundry than it is the name on the back. There's going to be your core players. There's going to be your players that are going to be part of an era of baseball, hopefully an era of success and championships. Soto's going to be here. Lindor's going to be here. You hope that some of these young players, McClain and A.J. Ewing and maybe Carson Benj, they will be core players. As they incorporate these young players, you hope that they're going to be the core that sticks and that you connect with, like you did with Pete Alonso, like you did with Diaz, like you did with DeGrom, like you did for a time with Harvey and Syndergaard and Wright and Reyes, on and on and on and on. But there are going to be guys that are going to come and go. In this Dodger run, Darvish, Scherzer, Machado, there's going to be others I could probably name. They're just in and outs. And yeah, there's Hall of Famers there. Machado could be a Hall of Famer. Scherzer's going to be a Hall of Famer. Trey Turner, maybe. Long way to go. Too soon to talk about that. But that's where it's at. So I would not extend Freddy Peralta. I would take a step back. Let's see what he's made of. Let's see if New York's for him. Let's see if the Mets could do better. Would I love conceptually today here on February 1st in 2026, way before pitchers and catchers, a couple of weeks before pitchers and catchers, and way before we're even thinking about the trade deadline, what I would love to dream about a Skubal Peralta top of the rotation with McClain and two other young pitchers behind them in the coming years as you move away from Senga and Manaea and some of the, you know, veterans that were maybe the stopgap? I would love that. Homegrown pitchers with two established studs at the top, an elite rotation. But too soon to really worry about that. And the fact that I'm even thinking about that, you want to have as much flexibility as possible. Remember, signing Peralta, giving him $30, $35 million, whatever it's going to take to get him, could impact you on what you could do on the offense, could impact you what you could do with other pitchers. You just don't know if there's going to be a restriction on transactions at certain plateaus of payroll. Forget if there's a salary cap. That alone will be a restriction. I have a hard time believing that's ever going to happen. So take a step back, breathe. Let's just enjoy Freddy Peralta for 30 starts. If he's who we hope he is, the Mets will be able to sign him in November of this year, December, and they'll be able to compete. You can't live your life worried about the Dodgers swooping in and stealing everybody. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And by the way, what the Dodgers are doing, especially with the deferrals of money, it's not going to last forever. Trust me, it's not going to last forever. I understand it's LA. I understand the weather. I understand that there's all that stuff we've talked about. Nothing lasts forever. Trust me. So, all right, let's take a quick break. When I come back, are the Mets in better hands with Justin Willard? What do I know about him? What's his philosophies? There's not a hell of a lot out there. He was on a podcast. I've done some research. I think there's going to be one core theme when it comes to the transition from Hefner to Willard. And I think there's one part of current club that he can improve upon. And I think the real reason they brought him in is because of his ability to work in an organization and use different resources and different types of ways of building pitchers' capabilities. So we'll talk about that right after this. We're back, and figured I'd use today our final show before the Super Bowl, where we take our, I guess we could call it, ceremonial week off. There will be still some extra innings in between. It's not like I'm not going to do anything. We're going to focus more on the premium content, obviously follow things on X. If there's breaking news, I'll come to you. Don't worry. But I think that we always like to use, I mean, think about it. Super Bowl Sunday, you guys are more focused on enjoying yourself, and there's going to be plenty of baseball. We're going to be overloaded with baseball from pitchers and catchers, which is around Valentine's Day, all the way through hopefully late October, and the Mets win a championship, maybe November. So we could dare to dream today on this cold February morning, which I got to tell you, looking at the weather, I mean, you want to see a scenario where you're about as far away from baseball as possible. Can't even dig yourself out because of the ice and the snow being so, you know, entrenched because of the cold. It was like single digits here out on Eastern Long Island. So I don't know where you are. Hopefully you're staying warm, you're staying safe, and hopefully watching, if you're into baseball and you're missing baseball, I'm sure there's plenty of clips you could watch. You could listen, obviously, to Talking Mets and some of the other great shows that are out there, whether it's our friend Ernie Dove or some of the other great content creators that I think do an awesome job in making this. And I will tell you, before I get to my point and talk about Justin Willard, I think that we have to remember that if you do some searches, there are other towns with passionate baseball fans that don't have the access to the kind of content that we have here as Mets fans, because just not a big enough fan base, and there's not the same type of caliber of content creators out there. So always like to throw that out there, and this is just one stop. I know that we have loyal listeners, one stop in many. So I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I'm an expert and I've done interviews with Justin Willard or talked to people that know Justin Willard, because I haven't. I think that what I've been able to do is really look at where the Mets pitching has been under Jeremy Hefner, look at what those that have been around Willard or fans who have followed content creators followed Willard, and get a feel about what the perspective was about a coach that wasn't even on the big league coaching staff in the front facing. He was kind of a behind the scenes guy. Minnesota, he was a pitching coordinator. With the Sox, he was more front facing, let's put it that way, when it came down to it. Let me just look at it. Coaching, he was a director of pitching, minor league pitching coordinator. So there was more of a, I guess, front-facing maybe, but still not necessarily in the dugout, not going out there making pitching changes, not somebody that the national media or the average fan would have a lot of knowledge about. But he certainly had impact in both of those organizations. Now, before we get to Willard, here's what I feel. I thought long and hard, because I thought Jeremy Hefner was a great pitching coach. I thought the Mets made strides, and I think part of maybe the feeling about Hefner and his how good he was, that the Mets have had bad pitching coaches for a long time. I thought Rick Peterson over the last 30 years was maybe their best pitching coach. I thought Dave Wallace did a really good job late 90s under Bobby Valentine when they won a pennant. But other than that, the Mets have had very weak pitching coaches. And I think part of the problem was with the whole Terry Collins, Dan Worthen tandem, the Mets hitched their wagon to two guys that were mediocre. And I think got really lucky because Harvey and DeGrom and Wheeler and Syndergaard and Mass, these all guys came up at the same time. They all struck gold with these pitchers. These pitchers were good, but they weren't really made better on a health and sports science standpoint or from any other performance standpoint by Dan Worthen. I mean, the whole thing about Dan Worthen was an old school pitching coach, the Worthen slider. Okay, you tell them to throw sliders. And I think I will get to this in a minute with Willard. Just because he could throw a slider doesn't mean that's the right pitch. Doesn't keep him healthy. Things like that. I really think that Dan Worthen did a lot of harm, and that's why that group of players never, I think, achieved the heights outside of 2015 and maybe a few individual performances after that they could have. And they fizzled out. There are other reasons for that and so on and so forth. But so the Mets haven't really had a great pitching coach for a long time. Hefner comes in, young mind, more modern. And right away, you're like, hey, this is perfect. Like, finally, the Mets have themselves a really good pitching coach. And look, over the last, and we'll take the COVID season, his first season out because it's so wonky. But if you go from 2021 to last season, Fangraphs has them as a top 10 pitching staff in the league, according to WAR. And they've had some really good moments. Now, keep in mind, you've had some really good pitchers that have put uniforms on. Diaz and Scherzer. I know that he was at the end of his career. DeGrom. Bassett had a good year. Manaea's had a good year. Look, you want to credit Hefner for that? Sure. I mean, he came here and with the support of the staff and Hefner revived his career. Same thing with Luis Severino. And Hefner was really good with working with Diaz and maximizing Diaz to become arguably the best closer in baseball. Now, one of the things that I think that has been a trademark of this club and has actually hurt them and I think has kept them out of the postseason and has been a big problem on many fronts, and I've talked about it over and over and over and over again, is that the Mets are ninth in walks in baseball, the most walks in baseball since 2021. They were top three in walks the last couple of years. Starters in particular killed them last year with the second most in walks. Now, the fact that they're even a mid-tier pitching staff last year, and I know this first half, second half, June, like around June 12th, things went haywire. Everything averaged itself out to being who you are. Like, you could take spots of the season and say, you were really good here, you were really bad here. At the end, the total number is who you are. And how consistent you are from day one to day 180, 162 games in 180 days, is I think, what determines what kind of player that you really turn out to be. Consistency is what everybody's trying to find. That's always the elusive thing. But this is a team that, in a lot of ways, and I think this is where Willard is going to be valuable, has prioritized stuff over throwing strikes. I don't see any pitcher come out of that bullpen. And look, guys like Reed Garrett, nasty stuff. Kodai Senga, nasty stuff. I mean, plenty of guys with nasty stuff that have been through the grinder here. Nobody throws strikes. There's always runners on base. There's always walks. I don't see pitching to the score. I mean, how many times have you seen the Mets with a 5-6-7-run lead bring somebody in and they're nibbling the strike zone, and within a blink of an eye, there's a couple of runners on. And in the modern game, this is not 1984, where the bottom of the lineup has no power. In the modern game, add in the DH in the National League, most anybody could hit pop a home run. Really. You're up 5-0, seventh inning, walk, home run, it's 5-3. Now you got a game. And how many times have we seen that? Now, I know that's anecdotal and I don't have data behind it, but look, you watch the games, you know. And I think that what really got Jeremy Hefner fired, I don't know if it was just he had peaked and what happened in the second half. I'm sure that played into that. But maybe the pitching staff wasn't as good. Maybe the philosophy wasn't as good as we thought. I think we got dazzled a little bit by Severino and Manaea, and those were good notches in his belt. And look, he got a job right away, so it's not like he's a bad pitching coach. But when you start to think about 21, 22, 23, what young pitcher really came to the big leagues and got better? Think about that. Veterans are holding up on the thing. Yeah, you help with Senga's transition to the States, but what young pitchers? And it's been a long, look, the Mets have not developed pitching since the five aces, whatever you want to call those guys in 2015. And let's remember, they didn't develop all those guys. They developed them, but they didn't draft all of them. But they developed them. Like, they developed Syndergaard, they developed Mats. Mats was the organization a long time. He had a lot of ups and downs. Harvey, DeGrom, Syndergaard. They did a good job going up the line. Some of those are the old school coaches, the Frankie Violas, who are now the dinosaurs that are not around anymore. So you got Jeremy Hefner. We feel Hefner is this great pitching coach. Got a job almost instantaneously after getting fired. But can they do better? And I think that when Stearns talked in the offseason, that was the theme. Can they do better? Now, why would Justin Willard be any different? Well, here's what I have found out about him. In a league where I think conformity, and if you go back to, there was a book by Travis Sawchuk, the MVP machine, around 2015, 2016, 2017, there were principles, drive line was one of them, whether it be on offense or pitching, that, hey, okay, this is what makes a good player. This is what makes you elite. And always there's always foundational principles. But I think that the sport has gotten to the point where there's so much conformity that you take every pitcher and you say, okay, this is who you need to be. Instead of looking up a pitcher and saying, okay, here's what you're good at, and here's how you could take certain principles within the scope of your talent and be an elite pitcher or a very good pitcher or become the best version of yourself that you are. And if you listen, and I highly recommend, there's this podcast called Baseball Isn't Boring. And Willard was on there right around when he got hired in December. And he talked with, I don't know the host's name, I apologize, but he was on the show discussing his philosophy. Now, I think that the funny thing is he uses this term, what's a pitcher's superpower? And it was funny because basically he's saying, okay, every pitcher has a strength, whatever it may be. It might be his extension. It might be his sweep. It might be his sink, his ride, whatever. And don't just think about pitches. Think about the process of the pitches. What is about him that is his superpower? And he's like, okay, enhance that superpower. Support it. Don't replace it. Don't look at that and say, okay, that doesn't work. When you have a pitcher that does something well, don't just throw it in the trash and start over. And we have a tendency in this league to do that. And I think that's where one of the biggest interesting differences with Willard is that he's saying, okay, there's certain tenets and philosophies here, but let's start there. And I think ultimately there's always that part, which is going to be any analytical front office, the ability to look at analytics, video. I mean, coming up, you know, Willard talks about coming up through the Twins organization, going through the development process in the minor leagues. Now, remember, this is a guy that never played professional baseball. He played, I think it was Concord University, Radford. He was a coach and a recruiter. So he came up through not even a major college. It's not like he was at UCLA or any of the big schools. You know, he was in just a college, good colleges, but colleges, nothing big. This is totally under the radar guy. Yes, there is always the video, the mechanical, the data and all that, explaining that to the players. But I think the philosophy and the core philosophy, which this is what really impressed me, was throw nasty stuff in the zone. That was a quote from him. Command is the foundation. And he even talks about it. If you have elite stuff, it's not going to matter if you can't throw for strikes. And his thing is, if you're throwing stuff in the zone and you're getting hit, well, now it's time to improve pitch quality. How many times have we seen Mets pitchers nibble around the strike zone? Or you've heard people say walks don't matter. As long as the elite stuff is there and the swings and misses are there, walks don't matter. Walks matter. Walks kill. And if you don't think, I mean, the Mets nearly didn't make the postseason in 2024, mainly because of the walks out of their bullpen. Now, I'm not saying that's all Jeremy Hefner's fault, but how many pitchers have come up through the Mets system and even into the big leagues before Stearns, and nobody throws strikes? We've talked about this. Here's a guy whose core philosophy is, you have elite stuff, you have a certain skill set, let's enhance it, Let's not nibble, but let's focus on command. Let's make sure that you're throwing strikes. Let's make sure that we're going after hitters. And from what I understand, someone who knows him a little bit, this is going to be a big part of the 2026 Mets. Now, all the other stuff, pitch design, how they go about developing pitchers, that from what I understand, he's not looking to come in here and revamp everybody. He's looking to say, hey, let's refine what you have, maybe make the current repertoire more purposeful, and work with that. I'm not saying they're not going to teach guys new pitches and stuff, because clearly, you look at Ernie Dove, they're going out there and they're working with them in the minor leagues. But I think that overall, there might be a philosophy here. Now, how, you know, he's a big league pitching coach. You have Eric Yeagers, who's there. You know, he's a driveline guy. Obviously, he had to sign off on this. I'm not saying Willard's going to have an impact up and down the organization. We don't know. I mean, you're the pitching coach. It's not like you're going down to St. Lucie in the middle of the season to go see what's going on down there. So clearly he has an alignment, and clearly there's an alignment with his philosophy, because they wouldn't bring him on to incorporate this into the Mets repertoire. And that makes me smile, because the fact that you could take a player, look at what they do well, try to work on that. And this is something that's been a problem, not just in sports and society all along. We tend to look at people, look at what they don't do well, and we try to always fix it. And we focus on, well, you don't do this, 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 and fix it. And we never say, okay, they do A, B, and C well. How do we maximize that to make them a valuable resource, whether that be in sports and business, whatever it may be? And from what reading about Justin Willard, that's what he's trying to do. I mean, I'm trying to take all the complex conversation about pitch shape, design, all the other stuff that you're going to hear. Oh, and there's going to be plenty of content creators that are going to throw all this gunk out there. Like high-level talk that's really just, you know, verbal diarrhea because they want to sound smart. You don't know. Like, we're not in the room. You don't know. And it's not like this guy's going to come here. And I think part of what I have to caution everybody, Stearns made it a point in his post, you know, the first game, you know, his post-mortem about the 2025 Mets to talk about coaches and supporting the players better. Clearly, when you read about Justin Willard, that's something that he's going to do. And Kai Correa and all the other guys they brought in, they have new hitting coach, all this other stuff. But they're not magicians. It's the players. And they're a tool and a resource. I've always said a coach is like an iPad. They're there. How you use it, how you implement the feedback, that's up to the player. So you have pitchers who can't throw strikes. You're going to work with them, obviously. Why is it? Why are they at command? But ultimately, if you can't do it, you can't do it. It will be very interesting to see if under Willard, the Mets attack the zone more. Will there be different game calling, different philosophies? I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think Hefner had a lot of control from the dugout of game calling. So these are a lot of small things, and I think the real jury will be decided on, you know, the jury's out now. The real deciding of Willard is, do you see some differences in how they game call, how they approach situations, when pitchers come in, the kind of pitchers they're bringing in? You know, they have some, we've talked about them on Trash or Treasures. You've heard, you know, some names. It'll be interesting with some of the Syracuse shuttle guys. There's going to be Syracuse shuttle guys that, you know, how what do they look like? Are they different? Are they just these guys that throw hard and have spin and can't throw a strike, and you hope that they throw enough good pitches to get themselves through whatever the situation is? So this is really, I think, when you talk about Justin Willard, I think it's really boiled down to two things: throwing strikes, but more importantly, focusing on what a player is really good at and maximizing that rather than transforming them into this lab. Sometimes when I hear the term lab, I think it's almost like you're taking, it's like a sci-fi movie. You're going to take this player, put him in like some kind of machines, blend them up, and he comes out the perfect pitcher. It's not what, I think that's what everybody would love to do. That's not real. I think it's more about how you can not only communicate analytics and the resources and the tools that are out there, but how do you take the player, know what he's good at, know his capabilities, his talent, and all the things that make him who he is at that point, and blend enhancing that with transforming him into something that, quite honestly, he probably never could be. I also think, and what I really was disappointed when they couldn't come to a deal with Tyler Rogers, that it's also important to have different types of pitchers on your staff. I mean, think about when you have everybody throwing hard, throwing sliders over and over out of the bullpen starter over and over. Look, nasty sliders, hard fastballs, we all know those are effective. But when a Tyler Rogers came in with a different arm angle and throwing strikes and getting ground balls, and I know that there's the whole batting average on balls in play and missed bats. I agree with all that. Missed bats definitely guarantee success. Look at Edwin Diaz. We watched Edwin Diaz for 7 years. That's why you felt good in the ninth inning because, yeah, he would walk people and he would give up home runs and he would have outings when he didn't have it. But the fact that he missed bats, even with bases loaded, nobody out, you felt he could get out of that because the more than likely the opposition wasn't going to make contact. But that's still a rarity. Not every pitcher could be that kind of guy. Sometimes coming in, throwing strikes, getting ground balls, that's okay too. The game existed for 100 years doing stuff like that. So we'll see. We'll see if there's some more diversity in the kind of pitchers that they incorporate throughout their bullpen. Can they improve the pitchers? Let's see this whole strike-throwing mantra, command. And can Justin Willard take pitchers who have really good, as he calls, superpowers? And it's a word he uses throughout the podcast and accentuate those superpowers and make them the best version of themselves they could be. If this works between the development up and down the organization and having a competent pitching coach at the big league level, a young guy, and remember, I think that's another important part. He's young. He's going to be able to understand these players, maybe even so more than Jeremy Hefner. Remember, Jeremy Hefner was not old, but he's kind of the pre-2015 generation when he pitched. This is a young guy. This is a guy that's going to get an act. I think we have to remember the kids coming up now, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, they weren't even around when Bobby Valentine, they weren't alive when Bobby Valentine was a manager for the Mets. I mean, when they were, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, David Wright was ending his career. Like, that's the kind of pitchers now that are coming up. And, you know, some of you guys who are young people, maybe in your early 30s, who remember, you're becoming the older guy now. Remember that. So this is another thing. You have somebody that could connect with what clearly is becoming a very young player development organization. So that was what I kind of learned. I thought it was interesting. More about Willard as we go along. I'm sure we're going to hear a lot about him in spring training. But I really thought I boiled it down to a really important concept. And I think if he can get the Mets, because they have talented players who have good stuff, to throw some strikes, you know what? Sky's the limit. You throw strikes and you have good stuff and you can figure out how to throw. And it's okay. Look at Nolan McClain. Sometimes it's just, yeah, you get swings and misses. Just weak contact. When you have good stuff and you miss the sweet spot of the bat, you're probably going to get an out. And you got to trust that your fielders could actually field the ball. That's why they got gloves out there. We get so caught up in swing and miss, swing and miss, swing and miss, swing and miss, swing and miss. Oh, what if the ball hits a divot and it goes into the outfield? Then it happens. And you know what? In this day and age with the way they manicure fields, when you get hit, yes, there's always errors and there's wonky things that happen. The game is so true now that if you're a big leaguer and you get a ground ball, you're going to make the play. You don't have to swing it. Now, there's situations where you want swing and miss, game situations, runner on third, you know, whatever. But I think that that's going to be one of the biggest themes. And it'll be very interesting. One of the biggest things I'll be watching is the difference in Mets pitchers this year under this pitching coach. And not so much transforming, you know, the Manaias and the Severino types from zero to whatever. But and maybe they will do more of that if they just focus on what really, when you listen to him, are basic principles. So, all right, let's take a quick break, wrap up. When I come back, a few mailbags, a few comments, and then we'll wrap up and we'll head into what we call our Super Bowl break. And we'll have more right after this. All right, we're back. And, you know, on the whole, Justin Willard, and I don't like doing this because we always, there was one last thing I was thinking about over the break. We always kind of like, oh, look at what was done in Minnesota and Boston and his impact there, because it's like the whole Severino and Manaea thing. Like, we give Hefner credit, but it's an organization, it's the player. You don't know what kind of individual coaching they're getting outside. I hate to do that, but there is information out there that, especially when he worked with Pete Mackey in Minnesota, Sonny Gray had a turnaround year, Pablo Lopez had a turnaround year, Lewis Varland and guys like that were able to get themselves, Bailey Ober were able to get themselves, in a different, basically to the big leagues. And then, there's even talk about how he had helped Greg Crochet and Lucas Giolito. And if you remember old friend Justin Wilson having a turnaround year in Boston. So he's a part of that. I'm sure the Mets saw that. The Mets aren't just going to pluck this young guy at a Boston system, give him a pitching coaching job if he doesn't know what he's doing. So just keep that in mind. But I think that the tenets and what exactly he's doing, which is simplifying a lot of the analytics and the video, the thought processes. Sometimes we make pitching out to be, and it is a complicated thing, but it's just simply the old work fast, throw strikes. Come on. What is it? The Ray Miller, what was it? Ray. I always forget the three mantras. Ray Miller, Pirates, philosophy. Like, look that up. Like, right? Work fast. What was it? Work fast, throw strikes, change speeds. Isn't that what it's all about? Work fast, throw strike. Now, there's so much to that. Back in the old days, you could tell a pitcher, work fast, throw strikes, change speeds. Well, do you know how to do any of that stuff? I think that's where Willard comes into play. But that's what it is. I think I should get that. You know what I'm going to do? And I'm going to maybe get a sign. I'm going to have a sign made. Work fast, throw strikes, change speeds. I'm just going to do that. I'm going to put it up somewhere in my office here. Maybe I'll put it, obviously my office is my studio. Maybe I'll hang it up behind. So when I do a Zoom, the few Zooms that I do, the few videos, you'll see it behind there. Maybe I'll post it. So work fast, change speeds. Work fast. Hold on. Ray Miller. So here I am. I'm saying my own. I'm saying my work fast, throw strikes, three change speeds. That's it. Work fast. I'm flubbing up my own philosophy. But yeah, that's what it's really all about. So let's get to some mailbags. Steve wrote, I can control Substack again. I don't have to download your podcast as a worker anymore. Hey, great, Steve. I think that. So if you guys are extra inning subscribers, you get the commercial-free podcast, and there will be premium content. So during the season, we'll probably do more video. I think the off-season, we've done a lot more writing. But during this season, in between shows, not every night, but when there's something pertinent to talk about, like these little shorts, I'll come to you, and those premium subscribers will get that in a podcast. Now, I know it's on Spotify. I'm trying to get it on Apple. Apple's a little more complicated. But if you are able to be a Substack app subscriber, I think it just comes up on the bottom, almost like it's a, you don't have to download it and go into the actual, post. I think it just is almost like a podcasting app within the Substack app. I know you don't want another app. So if you're on Spotify, you can get it. I'll eventually get it on Apple. I think because you have a current Apple free podcast that you got to be careful about how you duplicate an Apple, but we'll get it going. So hopefully give me feedback. If you're an extra innings subscriber, we rebranded it from Beyond the Mic to Extra Innings. Kind of something I thought made more sense. Beyond the Mic was cool with Mike and Mike, but it didn't fit what we were doing because we weren't just doing, we were doing microphone stuff. We were doing writing and sometimes video, but more often audio and writing. I'm not a huge video guy because I think if you do it, you have to do it well. It's a lot of work. You need a lot of equipment. You need to spend a lot of money to do it well. There are some guys out there that do video very well. There are Met content creators that are incredibly good at video, younger people than me. I'm an old school guy. I grew up on radio. I grew up on writing. And I think maybe does that limit my market? Maybe it does. Hopefully, even those that are more video-centric, younger people will appreciate it. Personally, as someone who is always around and about, whether it be doing something for the sports side of my life, the business side, in a car, I'm always on the go. Watching is hard because watching, you have to focus. I always want to listen. So I know some people are into videos, and as we evolve, things will change. So, Steve, I'm glad that you are enjoying the Substack, and I hope others sign up if you haven't. Great free trials. As a matter of fact, I'll do something fun. I have some coupons here for the cold. If you're cold and you're not a premium subscriber, the first five people to email me over the next few days at Mike Salat, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. We'll get a free 30-day trial of extra innings. So if you were listening and paying attention, I still have some coupons to give people out that hopefully, before they go stale, that hopefully you'll enjoy. So there you go. The rest of the puzzle, Steve wrote to me the rest of the puzzle. Now, he sent this to me early in the week. He would like the Mets to sign a veteran to caddy for Benj. He mentioned Austin Hayes, who obviously was signed by the White Sox. And, you know, I still wonder with the Mets 40-man roster if they're going to add anybody. You know, and I'll bring it up right now as we talk, because you look at Mets 40-man roster. There isn't a... Now, like I said, there are guys that you could put on the 60-day IL, like Reed Garrett, like Daniel Nunez. I don't think there's anybody else that needs to go on there. A.J. Minter might start the year on the IL, but I don't think he's a 60-day IL guy, so I'm not counting him. Maybe you could move a Joey Gerber off. But I look up and down, there's really nobody you could designate off. Maybe a Vital Brujan, who's an infielder, versatile infielder, but you're going to need some depth. Remember, during the season, when you want to bring somebody up, they got to be on the 40-man. So they're setting it up where they're going to shuttle people on the 40-man. I know Jared Young is still on the roster. He's still intriguing. He's an interesting bat. He didn't really get a chance to play, but he hit well in the minors. So I wonder if they're going to give him more of a chance. And there could be trades in spring training to open up spots. But right now, I don't see a lot of opportunity. There might be two 60-day IL slots that'll pop up. Maybe Kimbrel, if he makes the club, is one of those. I don't see, you know, would a Conforto sign a minor league deal with one of these guys? I mean, as far as an outfielder caddy, you got Young, Taylor, Soto, Robert Jr., Morabito, and then you really don't have anybody else that could play the outfield. So it would make sense for the Mets to go out and get another outfield. Now, there are a bunch of veterans still available on the market. I know that Austin Hayes, who probably wouldn't have played enough to really matter, is one of them. We've talked about them enough. And I am all for a veteran caddy out there. But when you look at who's available, would they come to spring on a minor league deal? Marte is the most logical one, and I don't know where they're at there, but I don't think he could play the outfield every day. Conforto's out there. I know that there was some talk about Kiner Falefa being an option. They talked about that over the Athletic, even to maybe play second base. He's versatile. He's more of an infielder, but I think he plays a little outfield. So he's out there. I've heard the Yankees being interested in Randall Gruchick. Tommy Pham is out there. Mike Talkman is out there. You know, maybe Mike Talkman is an option. I know our good friend David Mills, who does some contributions for extra innings, talks about him a little bit. These would be guys, you know, Mark Canha, these would be guys that have to be comfortable coming to camp on a minor league deal and maybe spending some time down in Syracuse. So depending on how Benj does. Now, to be fair, you're right. You know, Brett Beatty also might be that option in the corner if Benj flops. The more you hear about Benj, the more you just don't feel he's a guy that's going to flop. I mean, you have to always assume he might need more development. That was always kind of the feeling. The Mets feel really good about him, more than I expected them, after he struggled a little bit at AAA when he got the promotion last year. So there's that. And then also Steve brought up Eric Chavez. Now, I haven't really been spending a lot of time with the Eric Chavez rants on social media about Stearns, trashing the organization, calling Stearns a used car salesman. Here's my feeling about Chavez and others like Chavez, who was actually a very respected coach that the Yankees hired when he came over from when Billy Epper poached him from the Yankees. There's a generation of players, I said that 2015-ish demarcation line, who are still pretty old school. Chavez played in the late 90s into, you know what, 2011, 2012, 2013, around there. And I believe that the league is passing them by. The coaching situation is passing them by. I'm not saying all of them, but a good chunk of them. The league's getting younger. They're hiring younger kids. They're hiring people out of college. I mean, the Giants hired a coach out of college. Willard, we just talked about him and his resume. And I think that between the data, the video, the communication style, we could complain about the generation and how they absorb information or how they handle feedback loops and all that other stuff. It's reality. And if you don't find a way to bridge that gap, you're just going to have a lot of issues. And to be fair, Chavez, any of the coaches that were hitting coaches over the last few years, guys like Beatty and Alvarez in particular, and I think those are the two poster childs for this, struggled at the big league level, got better in the minors, and to a certain degree, both of those guys came up in 2022. Let's be fair and be honest that if they, with their prospect status, first round pick, potentially top prospect in baseball with Alvarez, they should be further along in 2026 than they are. Now, Alvarez, some of that is injuries. Beatty, it's development. To be fair to Beatty, too, he bounced around the diamond. And maybe that's his future, to be like a better version of Jeff McNeil. So I just don't pay attention to Chavez. I'm not in the interest. It's annoying. Am I saying he's totally wrong? You know, look, some of the things about Stearns not being a great communicator with the players, maybe that's true. I think Stearns comes from an executive philosophy where he just doesn't get close to them. And he relies on his coaching staff, his middle managers, to do that. Some guys are good at it, some guys aren't. It could be a problem. I think being transparent and honest with players is important. But I think in his job, being disassociative to the emotion, Pete Alonso is the perfect example. Look, it came out this past week that the Mets would have signed Alonso and might have had a good shot at signing him if the Orioles didn't come in with that big five-year deal. Pete wanted the deal that he wanted. Pete could have been back here. The Mets probably would have worked out a 3 or 4 year deal. He didn't want to be here unless he wanted to be here under the guise of money. Diaz, I think, left because he wanted to be in the best chance possible to win, and he saw the Dodgers as that. Maybe he likes LA too. Maybe he likes some of the glitz and glitter over there. Don't put that past. Is that Stearns' lack of communication his fault? I don't know. There you go. Jason. First, Jason wanted to know that when's the last time I felt the weather being this cold? Well, Jason, here's the deal. I do remember a couple of times in the last 10 years it being this cold. I remember, the reason I remember it is because I kept, there was like the ice was, it was about 10 years ago and the ice was so bad that I like fell in a gas station a couple of times getting gas. And I remember getting so angry because the gas stations weren't cleaning up their mess because they had nowhere to put it. So I remember one time, but I will tell you, the cold has been brutal. This has been a brutal winter. Baseball can't come soon enough. The fact that I have all this snow on my property, my poor dogs, I can't find, they're struggling to find their way around my property. That to me is enough to say, hey, just get me up to a couple of 50-degree days, 45-degree days with rain. Let's get this slop away. But here's the thing, Jason, about the cold. All I know is Super Bowl. I've been saying it many times today. That's the demarcation. I enjoy the Super Bowl. It's going to be cold this week. It's probably going to be cold for another 7 to 10 days. But once pitchers and catchers hit, you're going to have a breakout day. There's going to be some warmth in the near future. And before you know it, we'll be talking baseball. And then you'll be complaining that the team is on a 10-game road trip. There's no days off. It's hot. And then we'll be complaining about the opposite thing, if you could believe it. Although, if this is any indicator of like winter lasting longer, there might be some Arctic days in April. You'll see Lindor I love the Latino guys, but sometimes they act like they're playing in Antarctica when it's 50 degrees or 55 degrees out there, and they're all bundled up. You can't even see their face. They might as well be, a football player at that point. So it's kind of funny because when people are from different climates, it's kind of funny how they overreact to the cold a little bit, but I get it. It's not, I have friends that are from Jamaica and they hate the cold. They couldn't wait to get out of here. When they saw the snow coming, I saw them packing their car up to go back home. I was like, I guess you're leaving for the snow. And they said, you betcha. So there you go. Jason had a couple other interesting things, here. He doesn't like the WBC. And it's not about patriotism. Look, I just feel like the WBC is a nice concept that is probably a postseason tournament where you would play after the season when there was nothing else. Now, I know they don't want to go and compete with football. I know they don't want to compete with basketball, the NHL, but football is a Sunday sport. If you had the WBC during the week in the prime time, maybe like November, December, you maybe have to play it outside the country in a dome. Or play it in a dome. You can play it in a dome here in the States. Nothing wrong with that. It might do better. I think that with the injuries, and I know the Mets fans with Edwin Diaz are still panicked about that. There's a number of players not able to get insurance. I know that that's a thing. I'm sure that'll be a conversation. I think right now, You get, especially for the Mets, it's important. The players to be in camp, working with the new coaching staff, getting to know each other, absolutely building a culture there. I think that, you know, that's part of it. WBC is a distraction at that point. Do I get into it? I don't know. It's hard. It's hard to get into it. And I think the game is so global now. Yeah, we're Americans. We want the USA to win. But there's a ton of people here in this, you know, Italians, things like that, that probably would just as like to see the Italian team win because their family is from Italy. I don't know. I just, it's not something that I've ever really gotten into. I've wavered on it. There's always that David Wright walk-off moment. So there's been these little moments that have been pretty cool. But in general, I'm not into that. And then the final thing before we wrap up that Jason brought up is he didn't understand my lukewarm stance on DeGrom. And he's right. Look, DeGrom has two of the top 10 pitching performances in team history. He's third in WAR behind Gooden and Seaver in pitching. And, you know, his WAR is higher than Beltran and Strawberry and Hernandez, Piazza, Alonso. It's funny how fans put Alonso in that same category. Yes, and it's a great point by Jason. He brought us A.J. Ewing with the draft compensation when he left for Texas. What I find interesting about DeGrom and the lukewarm about DeGrom, I think that DeGrom, personality-wise, never really was a big New York guy. I mean, anytime he was spoken to post-game, he was awkward. I've heard some people that have covered him say he's not the friendliest guy in the clubhouse, but maybe that was just a snapshot in time. I never felt that as he got deeper into his Mets career that he wanted to be here. Yeah, he signed an extension in 2019. I wonder if you put truth serum into him, if he regrets that. That was a little bit of an undervalued contract. If he had waited, perhaps he would have potentially gotten more. He wound up getting his bag from Texas. I know that there's been some rumblings that the Mets wanted to bring him back after 2022, but he didn't get, similar to Diaz, he didn't give them a chance to match. I feel like the fact that DeGrom, and there was so much media buzz that he didn't want to be here the final couple of years, 21, 22, that we focus, or at least I have focused more on the fact that, well, he didn't really want to be here. He wasn't the friendliest, most charismatic guy. That doesn't mean anything. He was a great performer on the field. His 2021 season before he got hurt was an all-time season. I mean, it would go down as the best Mets season pitching performance. I think putting aside WAR and all that stuff, it's the best Mets season, individual season. And I was too young to see Doc. And I know that there's those in the audience that saw Seaver. But, I mean, when you look at his 2021 from a WAR perspective, because he didn't pitch enough, it doesn't hit the top 10. I'm looking for his 2020. Yeah, it doesn't even hit the top 10. Yeah, it's barely better than some of his other, like, non-Cy Young seasons because of the fact that he didn't pitch enough. Now, he pitched five innings, and he pitched lights out. And those five innings or six innings were probably the best five or six innings you're going to get. And if he had been a little healthier maybe in 21 and 22 and he didn't have missed half the season, both those seasons, who knows? But I think that's my lukewarm response. Will he get his number retired? I don't know. He's definitely Mets Hall of Famer. We're so far off from that. I mean, there was even talk, I thought, well, maybe there's a way as his contract winds down in Texas, is there a chance for a reunion? I just don't think DeGrom is a New York guy. I don't think he likes it here. I don't think he likes the culture. I don't think he likes the politics. I don't think he likes a lot about New York. And, you know, maybe it was the organization because of the turnover, the Wilpons, and he didn't have much exposure, only a couple of years of exposure to Cohen during Cohen's early years when Cohen was trying to figure things out, so maybe that didn't help. I guess that's my lukewarm response. I love DeGrom. As a matter of fact, he was my favorite pitcher on that staff, more so than Harvey, because I always remember his moxie in Game 5 of that wild card series in 2015 when he didn't have much and he battled through it. That, to me, was DeGrom's defining moment as a Met. He could have got his doors blown off in L.A. that night, and he kept them in the game, handed it to Syndergaard. Syndergaard handed it to Familia, and the Mets won a tough, decisive game in a tough environment on the road and went to the World Series. And that, to me, was the night they won the World Series because they took that momentum and they blitzed Chicago. And that momentum got snuffed by that quick pitch home run to Gordon in Kansas City, or else who the hell knows if the Mets win that game, what happens. So what if? So that's it for this mailbag. Send me more. Look, like I said, even though we're taking a little bit of break, there'll be plenty of extra innings. We'll be answering emails. The mailbag will resume the week after the Super Bowl. We'll have our big pitchers and catchers report. We'll start to break down positional battles. We'll start to look at some interesting names to look at in spring training. The Mets roster is set, but I think the bullpen is going to be interesting. I think watching Carson Bench is going to be interesting. Obviously, we're getting to know some of the new players, Bo Bichette, Jorge Polanco. And as far as the roster, I just don't see anything more, but I'm sure with the amount of veteran free agents out there, there may be some opportunity for the Mets to maybe sneak in and grab somebody, although I don't think it will be anybody of significant stature. It might be more veterans looking to come in and prove themselves and see if something opens up with an opt-out or something like that. So we'll see. All right, that's it for the latest edition of the Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And you could join me on the new improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Free chat, extra innings, premium content, updates on the show, interactions with me, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Stay warm, enjoy the rest of your week, and we'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast. Not next week, but 2 weeks from now, post-Super Bowl. Till then, take care, everybody.